Our next guest is full of contradictions. It figures then that he's a writer, and a great one at that. He's reported on the international art world and reviewed fancy restaurants for fancy magazines. He's also lived in a squat and downed goat milk only a few seconds after it left the goat. He's perhaps most famous for a book about depression and draws on a personal history with the disease in his public life. He's also pursued history with a capital H, visiting about half of the world's countries in the last 3 decades and writing about them with deep reserves of hope, compassion, and curiosity. Places on the brink of change are the settings for his latest book, Far and Away. The author I'm talking about is Andrew Solomon. Solomon is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University and president of the Penn American Center, an advocacy group for freedom of expression. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker, NPR, and The New York Times Magazine, among many others. His book about depression, The Noonday Demon, won a National Book Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Solomon joins us today to talk about Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 Continents, 25 Years. Andrew Solomon, welcome to The Exchange.
What a pleasure to be here.
It's really a pleasure to speak with you. I so enjoyed reading and reviewing this book. And We begin in your childhood. Could you tell us, what did you learn about traveling from your mother?
My mother was a great enthusiast for travel. She was very interested in the world and in going places, and I feel it was one of the great gifts she gave me, was that inclination towards seeing things. She liked to see things from a little bit more of a distance than I've ended up seeing them. She went to places, but she didn't engage with the population the way I did. But she always wanted to see places and to understand places. And she always said, when you travel, you should always assume that you're coming back. If you think you're not going to come back, you'll try to see everything and you'll end up seeing nothing.
So, but this idea of being outside of a place, you ditched that pretty early on in life. How and when did you first get beyond touristic notions of travel?
Well, I sometimes say that tourism is the experience of going to look at something without being directly affected by it and without directly affecting it, and that travel involves engaging with the place where you go. My first big adventure really was the summer after college when a friend of mine was working as a photographer in the American Embassy in Morocco, and I went up to Morocco and I ended up touring around there on my own. So I guess I was 20 or 21 at the time. And I really felt that this was such a different place and there was so much that I needed to understand to make any kind of sense out of it, and that I wanted to talk to a lot of Moroccans. And I think we kind of oversell the idea of journalistic neutrality, not that I was even a journalist then, but I think if you go someplace, it changes you and you change it. It's better to acknowledge that than to try to pretend you can get around it.
So how has engagement and reciprocity in foreign places changed since that first trip to Morocco? Your friend, she stood you up at the airport, right, and you were immediately, it was your first time reckoning with maybe feeling in danger in a foreign place. And over the decades, it seems like that fear has subsided. You know, where did you find engagement and reciprocity were the most challenging?
Well, I mean, they're challenging in different ways in different places. You know, the toughest places I've gone, I think, would be Afghanistan, Libya, and Rwanda. I would say those were the three toughest. But it was pretty tough. I was in South Africa at the end of apartheid. And the most direct confrontation with the military that I've had was when I was in Moscow during the coup in which the Soviet Union ended. And my most direct experience of violence actually came when I was writing about a museum exhibition in Taiwan, and I got punched in the jaw by somebody who was angry about the exhibition. So I've had the full gamut of experiences.
Yeah, that might be the first anecdote I've heard of someone being punched in the face over cultural patrimony. And I want to visit all these places, or at least as many as of them as we can in the hour. Although, first kind of thinking about where these stories come from, they all recall a certain place at a particular time. And many of the writings in your book, your new book, Far and Away, were published in various magazines. Did you go back and edit or rework these memories to republish them?
I did a lot of reworking, not in general to put in new information or to sort of adjust them to make them look more prescient than they were, but to make sure that the voice was consistent, to fix some stories that I felt had gotten mutilated in the editorial process, to give full-length versions of some things that got truncated when they were published. And then I went to each of them and I wrote an introduction and a conclusion to contextualize the piece and to say what happened since then and whether things had turned out the way that I thought they would. So it was a great deal of work. I'd sort of thought, oh, it's an anthology. I'll just scan in some old stuff and then it'll come out. It was actually more than a year of really focused and steady work on it to make it flow. And I think, and I hope, to make it add up to a message so that it isn't just here's information about one place, here's information about another place, but rather I hope a book that's about the world and about our need to be open to the world, our need not to allow ourselves to get closed down or narrow in our perspective.
Did your process of assembling all these writings, and I think they begin in the late 1980s and bring us right up to the present day, did your worldview shift or in some way face a challenge that maybe you weren't anticipating as you put this book together?
Well, the two things that are difficult to separate are the way in which my worldview has shifted and the ways in which the world itself has shifted. Mm. We've moved into a globalized world in this period of time. I didn't time the book to come out during this electoral season, but it comes at a time when I think many politicians are exploiting people's anxiety and fearfulness about otherness and other places. So there were all of those ways in which the world has changed. But, of course, my perspective changed, too. I mean, I was a naive kid when I started. I think the most fundamental change that really struck me as I worked on it is that many of the places I've reported from have been in a moment of transition of one kind or another. And I've been in those countries at times of enormous hope. And I had the idea that that hope was needed to reach fruition. And over time, I've realized sometimes it does, often it doesn't. It's still a valid experience.
Well, the pages of history are not always as progressive as we might like them to be. We'll be talking more about great historical moments and a man who's been in the middle of many of them. Our guest today, Andrew Solomon. His new book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change. And he will be back. I'll be back, Emily Curitan, and hopefully you'll be back with us to join the discussion after a short break. Phone number and email address are on the way. Thanks for listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guest today, Andrew Solomon. I'm Emily Curitan, and you are invited to join our discussion. Phone number is 800-838-3760, or reach us on email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Andrew, your book, Far and Away, we begin kind of with your fascination in England, but I want to go to Russia or the Soviet Union. Your initial plans to visit that place were delayed by some catastrophes, the invasion of Afghanistan and then the Chernobyl explosion. Why were you so determined to visit the Soviet Union?
I was always intrigued by the history of Russia, and I'd wanted to see the great palaces that were outside what was then Leningrad. But I think more than that, I have a tendency to be drawn to the places that frighten me, and the Soviet Union was, after all, our biggest opponent. It was the leader in the Cold War. And I wanted to understand what that otherness was like and what that place was like and what it would mean actually to know it instead of simply having it bandied around as the sort of the place that might destroy us.
And talking about being drawn to frightening places, the Soviet Union and Russia, they're particularly famous for repression in general, but homophobia in particular. I want to ask you, you know, where have you seen the most dramatic changes or the most frightening changes for gay rights in your world travels?
Well, I mean, gay rights have now become so dichotomized. You have any number of countries in which gay marriage has become legal, in which gay people can have families, in which all kinds of rights for gay people are fully appreciated. And then on the other hand, you have countries in which people are executed for homosexual acts, as has happened recently in Iran. I was working in Libya when I was there, I befriended a gay medical student. He then loaned his computer to somebody in his class who needed to finish something, who saw he'd been on gay websites, outed him to the entire community. He had to flee his town. He enrolled in a different medical school. When time came for him to take his medical school exams, the invigilator for the exam was someone from his old school who lunged toward him, and he ran. He never got his degree. And then after the fall of Gaddafi, things went from being terrible to being worse. And he said after three of his friends, and the videos are up on YouTube if anyone wants to see them, with their hands tied behind their back, marched into a mosque and shot in the back of their heads for being gay, he fled the country, and he's now trying to get admission to the United States. I mean, it's terrifying. You know, there were people in Saudi Arabia who were two men who were caught in so-called lewd acts with each other in privacy, who were sentenced to 7,000 lashes each and are permanently disabled as a result. And in much of sub-Saharan Africa, there's a great deal of anti-gay prejudice. You know, Mugabe in Zimbabwe refers to gay people as filth. Uganda wanted to pass a law making gay acts a capital offense. It goes on and on.
And are you hopeful still, knowing all that you know and being to all these places you've been to?
I believe that overall the tendency is toward liberalization, but I don't think you can ever count on the tendency continuing to be toward liberalization. I think you see backlash. I think we're seeing backlash right here in the United States with the recent legislation in North Carolina, and I'm concerned that there can be backlash on a much bigger scale. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're shuffling in the right direction, but I think there's a long, long, long way to go. And I think when you see situations like Russia's anti-gay propaganda law passed by or under the aegis of Putin as a way, I believe, of distracting the population from the real problems of the country, you recognize how willing people are to throw their gay populations under the bus.
We are talking with Andrew Solomon, a journalist. His latest book is called Far and Away. And we got on the topic of homophobia and gay rights because I started to ask you about your first visits to the USSR and then to Russia, which, you know, in my experience is famously homophobic. But, you know, tell us about your time in a Moscow squat in 1988-89 and what you found there, how it changed you.
I went to Russia having sold the idea to a British glossy magazine. I was living in England at the time, that Sotheby's was having a sale of contemporary art and that it was full of absolutely terrible art and that they were getting all kinds of people to come and bid on it in a sort of cheap commercial ploy. And then I got to Moscow, and my second day there, I was supposed to interview a group of artists, and I was stood up by my translator. And so I went to their studios by myself, and they said someone would come who could speak either English or French. And I waited almost all day in those studios and watched them interacting with one another. And what I rapidly understood was that this work looked banal to me, but was full of some kind of hidden meaning. And the meanings emerged in the relationship of the artist to one another. And eventually I understood that they had made the paintings look boring as a means of keeping out the KGB and avoiding unwelcome prosecution, but that actually the work was invested with what they believed to be great truths. They thought they were safeguarding truth in the face of a regime that was trying to annihilate truth itself. And I remember one of them saying to me many years later, when I was, in fact, living with them in this squat, which ended up having hundreds of artists all living in an abandoned military building just outside the central ring road of Moscow. I remember one of them saying to me, "You see, for all those years, we had been in training to be not artists, but angels." He said, "And now we encounter a Western commercial world in which we're called on to be artists who produce something and not angels who hold to high moral standards." And the tension between those two definitions of what art was seemed to me so incredibly powerful, and it was so deeply moving to me. And in the time that followed, it became so important to what happened in the history of their country. I had finished writing a book about those artists. I was in Moscow in the summer of 1991 for a little bit of quiet time. The coup in which the right-wing hardliners took over the Kremlin took place, and those artists were involved in building the barricades and helping the resistance to the coup itself. And on the third day of the coup, I had the experience of being with a group of them up near Smolenskaya, where some people had been shot the night before. Someone came running over and said, "There are tanks approaching the barricades. You've got to come to the barricades." We all filed up to the barricades. We didn't really expect to see tanks. There were rumors of them all the time. We'd seen very few. And a column of tanks rolled up. And the soldier on the front tank said, "If you'll get out of the way, there's no reason for me to hurt you," he said. "But if you won't, I have no choice but to run you down because we have orders to destroy this barricade." And these artists said, "Give us just a minute. Give us just a minute to tell you why we're here." And they said, "You don't remember what real tyranny was like. Let me tell you what it was like. It was terrible." And they said, "You say you're following orders, but you are choosing to follow orders. It is your choice." And they launched into a praise of democracy and justice that those of us born into democracy and justice would be hard-pressed to formulate. And the soldier on the front tank looked down at us, all so wet and so sort of pathetic, standing there in front of this homemade barricade. And he looked at us for a full minute, and he said, "What you've said is true, and we must bow to the will of the people. If you'll clear a little space so that we can turn our tanks around, we'll leave you your barricade." And they drove off. Now, the coup failed that day, and it ended up being the end of the Soviet Union. It didn't happen because of that episode, but because of many such episodes. And it gave me the feeling, which is the driving feeling of this book, and in some ways of much of my life, that if you can say things clearly enough and directly enough and understand them deeply enough, you can actually make some little shift in the tide of history.
What about when you return to Russia after the tides had definitively shifted? You go back in 1993, 1994. Did the artists that you knew who had been making these somewhat boring-looking paintings that were riddled with integrity and inside jokes, did they suddenly throw off their slyer forms of expression and produce work that looked really different or really democratic?
You know, some of them were able to make the transition and ended up being very successful commercial artists in the West. Some of them continued to make art that they just showed to a small circle of friends that was almost, as one of them said, like the Freemasons, a little society of those versed in its vocabulary. And some of them felt a real loss of purpose with the shifts that took place and gave up the making of art altogether. And that was such a confusing time in Russia. The relationship with the West was so forced and peculiar. I mean, I remember in that trip in Moscow, which I have written about in the collection, going off and interviewing a bunch of Russian rap stars. And then I was talking to one of my artist friends and said, "Yeah, I saw this one and I saw that one." And he said, "But you know, for me, it is ridiculous for you to be seeing Russian rap stars as if I come to New York and I go to Harlem and find everyone in Ukrainian folk costumes playing balalaikas."
The moments of absurdity that you must have encountered and wondered, you know, is this absurdity or am I just sort of missing something by nature of being an outsider? Probably too many to count. We're talking today with Andrew Solomon. His new book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. I'm Emily Curitan, and you are invited to join this discussion, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Solomon has been front row seats for many of the most tumultuous moments of history in the last 30 years. We're just talking about the collapse of the Soviet Union. Andrew, you went there to write about art as a relatively young man. What has art taught you and writing about art taught you about politics?
Well, I would say that I was writing about art, but that even more I was writing about artists. And I think there's a kind of curious fallacy in which many reporters who go to do international reporting have two groups of people they talk to. They talk to government officials and business leaders, most of whom have an agenda and are going to say things which are relatively predictable and which are said with a purpose. And then they quote the so-called common people, and there are quotes from taxi drivers or from the person who served dinner in their hotel or the person who cut their hair. And my feeling is that in every society, there are reasonably large groups of intelligent, in many instances educated, thoughtful people who are trying to understand their own society, its structure, and how it relates to the rest of the world. And if you can tap into those people, into that large group, then you suddenly get a much clearer sense of what the place is that you're dealing with. So I came to feel that artists, visual artists, but also others who were interested in self-expression, were among the people who occupied that territory. I've come over time to feel as though this question of whether art is a moral act or whether it is a commodified act is an intense and interesting one. I've recognized the sort of inherent snobbery whereby Westerners used to say that if the work being produced elsewhere looked like what they were doing, it was derivative, and if it looked different, it was provincial. I've come to understand that you can have the same painting made in two different places and that it will mean two completely different things to those audiences. I've come to appreciate context and how important it is to have the context and understanding of the society and of the person's vision of it in order to know why he's made the work of art he has and in what ways that art functions politically in his society differently than it would in ours.
Let's talk about context in China in the 1990s, the early part of the decade. You write about assuming that art coming out of Beijing and Shanghai would be comparable to what you'd seen in Russia and the Soviet Union during Glasnost. Were you right about that when you got to China?
There were certainly similarities in the experiences of the artists, and there were some similarities in that business of meanings that were buried and hidden. That actually has a very long history in China. There are all kinds of complex buried meanings in Song Dynasty paintings from 1,000 years ago that were supposed to be commentaries on the politics at court, but not fully legible to the people at court. So there was that similarity. There was a kind of similar intensity. There were also very different preoccupations and some greater complexities. I remember in particular an artist named Zhang Peili in Hangzhou, who had been involved in the Tiananmen protests, and then afterwards said that he felt that the entire story of Tiananmen came to the Chinese people through the newscaster on Chinese state television. And he thought, whoever controls her voice controls China. And he thought, I would like to find some way to get to her. And he discovered she loved flowers. And he decided to stage an exhibition that was an exhibition of flowers. And he said, I had to choose a text that was neutral, neither hers nor mine. And he wrote to her and said he was doing this exhibition and offered to pay her handsomely to read aloud on video the text of the Chinese encyclopedia entry on water. And if you walked into that exhibition knowing nothing about it, what you saw was a big exhibition of flowers with a video in the corner with this woman reading an encyclopedia entry. But if you understood the thinking of that part of the world, you understood that Zhang Peili, an artist on the margins of society in Hangzhou, had ended up having the same control as Deng Xiaoping in determining what this woman had said. And when I talked to him afterwards about Tiananmen, and I said, how did he feel about it? He said, you know, he said, if we had succeeded in those protests, he said, there would have been chaos and probably hundreds of thousands of people would have died. They probably did the right thing. And I said, but how can you say that? You were one of the protesters. You were there. You saw them come in with those guns. And he said, idealism in the hands of an artist is a thing of great beauty, and it is our right as artists. Idealism in the hands of a leader is a terrible thing that leads only to destruction and despair. And I thought, this is a much more complicated relationship to ideas of democracy than the one that you would have in reading Western representations of China, and different really in kind from what I'd seen in Russia.
And how did this sense of, or a different perspective on idealism, in your mind, change the way people saw their own individuality, both as artists and as citizens in China?
Well, the focus on individuality, which is so prevalent in Western societies, and I'm speaking very generally, and obviously there are many exceptions to these rules, but that focus was less pronounced in China. There was more a sense in China of trying to think collectively and to engage with collective thought as being the way through. The Russians were very fiercely individualistic, and a communist system of conformity had been very difficult for them. The Chinese had many, many problems in their communist period, but the basic ethos of collectivity was one that was important to them. And even the very individualistic artists I met were engaged in questions of collective vision as part of the subject of their work.
We're leading up to a break here, but I am curious how you managed to get punched in the face over cultural patrimony.
So I got to Taipei when there was a loan exhibition coming from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I mean, coming from the Taiwan Palace Museum to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I was reporting on a simple, straightforward story about this wonderful loan exhibition, and then went back to New York, and then got a call from a friend in Taipei saying, "Do you know about the protests?" And I said, "What protests?" "Well, the collection in the Taiwan Palace Museum is the imperial collection, which Chiang Kai-shek took with him. It's the greatest collection of Chinese paintings that there is or could ever be in the world. So much of it was slated to come here, and many Taiwanese people felt that it could go down in a plane, that the Americans could return it to Beijing, where there were claims on it, that a number of other things could go wrong. And they had ended up saying, it is our cultural patrimony, and you have no right to it." And when I was in Taipei, I was out at a bar with a friend while these protests were going on. We were having beer with salted prunes, as you do in Taipei. And I was talking about the Met Museum, and someone turned and said, "Do you work for the museum?" And he socked me in the jaw. And he said, "Don't mess with our cultural patrimony."
Well, it sounds like the wrong place at the wrong time. Andrew Solomon has been in many interesting places during many interesting times. He is our guest today. We will be back after a short break to talk with him more about his new book, Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change. I'm Emily Curitan, and I hope you'll join our discussion. I'll give the phone number and the email address after a minute break. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan. Our guest is Andrew Solomon. He is a National Book Award winner, writer of many, many words over the years. His latest book is called Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents and 25 Years. That is not an overstated sweep. We literally go to all seven continents in this book. If you'd like to join the discussion and talk about some of the more tumultuous moments of history in the last 30 years, please do so at 800-838-3760 or drop us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Andrew, we've been reaching back into the early days of your work as a professional journalist and in a tumultuous time for global history, the early 1990s, late 1980s. I want to jump ahead to Bali in 2012. Something you said earlier about how your Russian translator didn't show up and you didn't speak Russian, and that has kind of made all the difference. You saw things in a way that maybe you wouldn't have seen them if you'd been relying on verbal skills. And I'm wondering, when you went to Bali in 2012, it was an unusual place with a more normalized relationship to nonverbal communication. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I had been writing about deafness in the United States, and I had learned from an Australian linguist I met that there was a village in northern Bali in which there's a form of hereditary deafness that's existed at least since the 18th century, and that in that village there is a sign language that grew up that doesn't exist anywhere else. And when I went there, what I discovered is that because it's a recessive gene that exists in this community, nobody ever knows whether they're going to have a deaf child or a hearing child, and you meet people with two deaf children and one hearing child, or in two deaf parents with a hearing child, two hearing parents with a deaf child. You meet all kinds of unusual circumstances like that. And as a result, everyone in the village of Menkala knows sign language. And when everyone knows sign language, it turns out that being deaf really isn't much of a disability because everyone can communicate with everyone. And when I would say to someone, they would refer to somebody, and I would say, "Oh, but is he deaf or is she deaf?" And they would comment on it, and it wasn't that they'd forgotten it, but it was sort of like saying, "Is he tall?" Or, you know, "Does he have dark hair?" Or, "Oh, do you mean that one who's a little bit fat?" Or something like that. It was just one more in a group of descriptors. And while on the one hand it was an impoverished village, and life in an impoverished rural village in Bali has its challenges, its substantial challenges, I also thought for deaf people it was kind of an idyll, because you realize the problem deaf people have had in most societies is that they can't communicate with anyone. If you can communicate with absolutely everyone, you know, you might miss hearing music or something, but you're not cut out of the fabric of society. It was very illuminating.
And how did you see people act or perceive the world differently with a different relationship to their senses or this normalization of deafness?
I just found that people weren't upset about it. You know, hearing person would marry a deaf person and didn't have a sense of sort of, oh, I'm entering into some strange area. And nobody said, are you fetishizing disability? And nobody said, what a noble sacrifice you've made. And nobody said any of the politically correct things that equally can get said here. It was the lack of interest in whether anyone was deaf that made that deafness so fascinating to me. That it didn't matter very much one way or another. It felt more just and more democratic and more generous in the end than our way of being.
Let's step back in time again and visit Senegal with you in the year 2000 or so. How does one come to be naked, covered in ram's blood, drinking a Coke and feeling pretty good about it?
Well, I had gone to Senegal because I wanted to report on the tribal rituals that are used for the treatment of depression in that part of the world. And I had a friend who had a Senegalese girlfriend who had a cousin who'd gone to school with someone who once knew someone, long chain of connections, mm-hmm. to a woman who actually performed the ritual for people with mental illness called an ndop, a form of exorcism. And I went off and I interviewed her. We had a very interesting interview. And at the end of it, I said, could I ever see an ndop? And she said, well, yes. She said, I don't know when I'll next be doing one, though. And I thought, well, I don't know how that's going to work. And just as I was leaving, she said, but, you know, she said, you don't look that great yourself. She said, I've certainly never done this for a foreigner before, but would you like an undop? And I thought, okay, sure, why not? And I left, and the friend with whom I'd gone said, you're completely crazy. You have no idea what you're getting yourself into. But we then went back some days later, and there was this ritual, which was all day long, and the high point of it, as is indicated in the title of the essay, was that I was in a makeshift wedding bed with a ram in the central square of the village. People were dancing around us, throwing sheets of cloth over us. At a certain key moment, all the cloth was pulled back. I was yanked to my feet. The ram's throat was slit, and I was covered in the blood of the freshly slaughtered ram. And I thought to myself, this is a far cry from psychotherapy as it's practiced on the Upper East Side in New York.
Well, did you feel better?
You know, I did feel better, and it was very striking to me how much there was that was potent in that ceremony. And when I was in Rwanda a few years later and was recounting the episode to someone there, the person I was talking to said, you know, we had a lot of trouble with Western mental health workers following the genocide. He said they didn't describe the depression as an external invasive spirit that could be cast out. He said, they didn't get people out in the sunshine where you begin to feel better. They didn't have drumming, which helps you to begin to get your blood circulating. And they didn't have, and this seems to me the most important part, the whole community take a day off from their work in the fields so they could all be together to help the person through their depression. Instead, they took people one at a time into dingy little rooms and asked them to talk for an hour about bad things that had happened to them. He said, we had to ask them to leave the country. And I really thought in Senegal there was no stigma around mental illness. You had a depression. Everyone knew it. Everyone was with you fighting to make it better. We could learn a lot from that.
We're talking with Andrew Solomon. And his book, The Noonday Demon, explored the stigmas around depression all around the world. It won a National Book Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is called Far and Away. It includes some writing that was in The Noonday Demon, as well as experiences from seven continents spanning 25 years. You're welcome to join the discussion with Andrew Solomon and me, Emily Curitan. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. And Andrew, thinking about depression and how much research and thought that you have put into it, both personally and as a cultural phenomenon, it's not something that often pairs well with travel. How did you manage to be such a prolific traveler and sort of wrestle with the noonday demon?
Well, in some ways, I think travel is the opposite of depression. Depression is a matter of closing inward and of ceasing to engage. And the point of my book of travel was that when I wasn't depressed, what I wanted the most was to be as fully engaged with the world as I possibly could be. So they sort of represent polar opposites in a way. But I also think that having gone through my depression, while I don't want to compare it to what some of the people I met had gone through, I had a sense of what it's like to be in a situation of great difficulty and try to make things work. And I think it made me a little bit kinder to the people I met and perhaps made it easier for me to understand their stories, both the joyful stories, which play a big role in the book, and the kind of tragic and heartbreaking stories in places like Afghanistan and Libya.
And going to Afghanistan, you went there in 2002, a pretty volatile time to find yourself at the National Gallery in Kabul. Tell us about that. Why'd you go and what did you find?
I went, I think, in large part because I had felt so frightened after 9/11, and I thought one way to deal with being afraid is to go and look at the thing I was afraid of. But I also went because I felt the press that was coming out described Afghanistan as a country of corrupt bureaucrats and warlike peasants, and I knew that couldn't be the whole story. And when I went there, I found so many people who, having been forbidden to make art or write poetry or perform music through the whole of the Taliban period, were now finally free to do all of those things again. I remember meeting one man who said that when the Taliban had made music illegal, he thought he would go mad until he realized there was one kind of music they could never make illegal. And he went to the market and he bought 20 doves, which he had flying around in the room we were in. It was a little messy, but there was sound. And then there was a group of people in Afghanistan, a group of musicians whom I'd met, and they said they'd like to, I met five of them, they said, we'll get our whole group together and play for you. There are 10 of us. I said, that would be fantastic. I said, do you want to come do it at my house? I said, it might be more comfortable. I have good heating, which was unusual in Kabul at that point. They said, yes. I realized I had these people coming to my house to play music. I invited some friends. The friends invited some friends. I invited the people I'd interviewed in Afghanistan. We ended up with 60 people. The musicians started playing at 5 in the afternoon, saying they would play for an hour. And they were so enthralled to have an audience, and we were so enraptured by the passion with which they were playing, that they ended up playing through one at a time, getting up to have something to eat, but otherwise just sitting there until 5 o'clock the following morning. And every note was swollen with the fulfilled longing of finally being able to play together again. It was a kind of ecstatic experience of music I'd never imagined and that I've never had anywhere else.
We're talking with Andrew Solomon. His latest book is Far and Away. Andrew, we've got an email dropped off here with some praise for you. It's from Chris in Ashland. Chris writes, it's a tremendous privilege to be hearing an interview with this great writer on our own JPR. Mr. Solomon has done a huge service to our culture with his expansive insights, courage, and just plain big heart. So that's from Chris in Ashland.
Well, that just about made my day. Thank you, Chris.
And I got to say, I agree that the compassion with which you write about people and places wherever you may find yourself, it is, to me, the overarching takeaway from this book and from your work over so many decades. You know, I'm wondering, though, you've seen so many changes with unpredictable and often terrible consequences, changes that may have at the time promised to be quite hopeful and quite wonderful. Has it made you more cynical or somehow less hopeful?
Well, I mean, of course, it's made me somewhat more cynical. But I also think that moments of hope have a lot of validity in the present tense, even if the hope won't be realized in the future. And one of the artists in Russia who I wrote about, Andrei Reuter, with whom I had dinner a few months ago, said, you know, he said, when I asked whether he felt totally disillusioned because of what has occurred in Russia under Putin, and that hope that was disappointed, said, even if it was disappointed, having had that experience of hope has informed everything that I've done ever since. And I thought, it's like a happy childhood. It doesn't mean you'll have a happy adulthood, but it changes your perspective. And I also came to realize that often you need to have 10 failed moments of hope before you get one that works, and that often hoping over and over and over again is the steady erosion that brings about significant social change. I saw that in South Africa, where things really are better. I saw it in Myanmar, where despite some very serious problems, things are better than they were under the military junta. I've seen it happen, and I know that you have to be disappointed over and over again, multiple inceptions, before you get the realization of your hope.
Andrew, we opened this interview asking you about what your mother taught you about travel. I want to ask you now, probably our last question, with what do you learn now that you're a parent and you travel with your children? What do they have to teach you?
We recently said to my son, George, he said, George, if you could go anywhere in the world, he was six at the time, anywhere in the world, where would you most like to go? And he thought for a few minutes, and then he said, Syria.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, Syria? George, why would you want to go to Syria? And he said, using a phrase that's become commonplace in our household, someone has to talk to those people about inappropriate behavior. So I think traveling with children, you rediscover everything. You have an excuse for doing the touristic side of things. But I also feel as though, even though my children are still relatively young at 7 and 8 and a half, I feel as though the process of awakening them to the complexity of the world, to have them grow up knowing there are different ways of living, different things to do, different kinds of people, different systems of values, I think is the most valuable thing there is. And in teaching them that over and over again, they end up teaching me also how readily a human being can adapt to very different circumstances and very different people. And that, we were talking about hope, is the basis of my greatest hope.
Well, certainly a lot of adaptations in your book. Well, I'll throw one more in here. You know, seeing your life in a historical lens like this, do you feel old or somehow caught in the past tense?
I feel old, of course. I'm actually 52, but it feels old. But I think I felt old when I was 40 also. I don't feel caught in the past tense because I feel like all of it actually accrues forward. I mean, okay, the places that I wrote about have gone through changes over a quarter century, the ones that I first wrote about. But in the end, I think looking at all of them, what I'm struck by is how much power there is in just in engagement. And I feel like the engagement feels just as alive and vital now as it did then.
And it is palpable in your book, Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, 7 continents, 25 years. Really a privilege to be speaking with you today. Andrew Solomon, thank you for being on The Exchange.
Thank you so much.